Hi, my name is Marcel, this guy. This is a talk about Gigatron TTL microcomputer that we built 2 years ago, and now we're still expanding. It's a two-person project, so my friend Walter, he could not come to Berlin this week, so I'm doing the presentation. My origin is that I'm a 6502 guy. I grew up with the Commodore 64, and Walter is he grew up with Philips computers and with MSX computers, and he's a Z80 guy, and we could never agree on which one is the best microprocessor, of course. And at some point, we decided that we wanted to make our own computer, because we were both, we met actually at university, we were both studying computer science. I'm working in chip manufacturing, or at least at that time I was working in chip manufacturing, and I realized that I knew a lot about the software, I knew a lot about building chips, but I never designed a circuit before, so it's about time to do your own computer. A lot of people do that, build your own CPU, actually build your own processor. There's a nice website, Homebrew CPU, with all kinds of people making fantastic designs to do their own processor and then build a completely working system out of that. So we also wanted to do that, but we did not want to copy one of the designs that was already out there. Our idea was, because we had no experience, let's build a CPU, a 4-bit CPU that can play tic-tac-toe on a LED matrix. That should be ambitious enough. Now, because everybody does this kind of things already, you have people who do it with relays, with TTL, with discrete transistors, and everything what you do is obsoleted by Raspberry Pis and Arduinos anyway. So you have to select your own boundaries within which you're going to work. And for us, it means you can decide on your building blocks. Very simple, we decided we wanted to use only 7400 logic chips. So these are the TTL logic chips. They have just a few logic gates in one package and nothing more. We didn't want to have the complex chips. You had very complex chips like the 74811, that has a complete ALU in it, that can do subtraction, addition, XOR, all of that, where you just give it a function and it will do the operation. We thought that's too complex, that doesn't help understand what is going on. And you have to decide on your data size for your project, because that is going to define how many parts you're going to need. And people do everything from 64 bits to 32 to even 1-bit computers. And for us, it was very clear we wanted to do an 8-bit system, basically without 6502 or Z80, so that settles the difference, out of 7400 series chips, but not the complex ones. So don't know what all of this is. You start by buying books from some famous book, the TTL cookbook, something Snicken, FPGA programming book. You buy parts, you buy an oscilloscope, this is literally what happens, and you buy an assortment from Jamaco. They have these boxes with 400 TTL chips, and well, should be enough. And then you build your first computer. How hard can it be? It's like Legos. You hook up a lot of lights. I did put a 818 in there just to see how it's working. I had a clock circuit there and a database is there, and it didn't work. It took me 2 days to realize that it didn't work, because it was counting. All the LEDs were nicely blinking, but I realized it was just the program counter I was seeing, and then nothing else was working. So you need to take a step back. At the time, there was Ben Eater. He had already put on YouTube a couple of videos about his TTL computer that he built on breadboards, and it was working. It's an 8-bit computer. It's very slow. It's designed for educational purposes, and it's called SAP, which means as simple as possible. And it comes from a textbook from John Merlino, if I'm right. And later he expanded his video series, and he goes at great length to explain every chip that is in there, every module that is in there. And the computer works, it can calculate the Fibonacci series. Basically, that is what it can do because it has a 16-byte memory. So there's not a big lot of big programs you can put in there. But we thought, oh, this is interesting, this architecture we can use for our tic-tac-toe program. Just need a bit, little bit bigger program memory, and then we're done. So that was our plan. Then we saw a YouTube video from this guy, a Canadian guy, who was using a single ATtiny 85 microprocessor. That's a very simple 8-bit microprocessor. He overclocked it to 32 megahertz. It's originally in 8 megahertz part. And that was it. There's nothing to it. It's an oscillator, a microcontroller with a couple of pins, and it was generating color VGA signals. It had I think it had stereo sound. Yeah, it had stereo sound. And he could hook up a game controller, an Atari joystick, and he could play a video game all from that little stupid, I think it has 8 kilobytes of program memory and 512 bytes of RAM, etc. Oh, wow. Software can create VGA signals. And this processor, he needs to clock it at 32 megahertz because every instruction takes a couple of cycles. So he gets a very coarse resolution at his very high speed. But then we were thinking, we were still working on our design, maybe we can combine these two ideas, that if our instruction set is efficient enough that it can do one instruction in every cycle and we can run it at a couple of gigahertz, then we have a system that can run programs and can also create video. And at that point, it started to go wrong. Because now I had a new goal. Instead of making tic-tac-toe, we wanted to make a computer out of only the simplest logic chips. It hasn't changed. It must be a single board, which means we wanted to have less than 40 chips. And that was basically guided by that we read that Steve Wozniak's breakout game was 44 chips, and the Ben Eater computer itself was also about 40 or 50 chips. But now we wanted to have video games with sound. First you have to figure out how to do video. So this is actually our first circuit that worked. And this is just a row of counters. Each chip is a 4-bit counter. This is an oscillator. This is an EEPROM, this is an EEPROM, and this is a register, and that's it. The output of the registers goes through a couple of resistors, and you don't see it on the picture, but those wires go into a VGA plug. And these counters, they fetch bytes from memory. The data from this chip goes into the address of this chip, and then in the end, pixels come out, and control signals come out. Those are the white lines that reset the counters at the correct time. And with that, you can generate video on a normal LCD monitor with almost nothing. There's no computer there. You see the output goes directly into the VGA plug. And we have a low resolution image. So this is actually 16 colors by 160 bytes, pixels by 120 pixels. But in the vertical direction, everything is quadrupled. So every line is drawn four times by this little circuit. So to make the signals compatible with VGA. And in the horizontal resolution, the resolution is also divided by four because this one was running at a quarter of the VGA speed. So it was, instead of running at 25 megahertz, it was running at 6.5 megahertz, something like that. But that works. That's, that was nice to know. Then it was a static image. It came from EEPROM. So the next thing we do, okay, let's update the circuit that the image comes out of a programmable or out of a non-volatile memory that can be changed on the fly. So it's basically still the same design. One of the EEPROMs is still there that generates the scan line numbers, actually. But then the pixels come here from the RAM. It goes still into the VGA plug. And then there is a little shift register, a row of shift registers here, and every scan line of the VGA, the RAM actually can perform a write operation, and it takes its address from the shift register and the data from another shift register. And there is a little microcontroller that puts new data into that shift register. And then we have a computer, a microcomputer, with basically a video card that can change the image on the screen all the time. And we made a little demo with that, which I don't have here. But basically, this is a video card. This whole circuit is a color video card, a very simple one, and you have a serial interface from your computer, and it, in our case, it was a little microcontroller. But you can also hook up our old 4-bit computer, if it ever were working, to it, and then you have a system with a TTL that can generate video, except we didn't want that because we figured out that it would be more than 40 chips to make this. And we thought this is not an interesting design. Now there's a lot of double complexity because the processor has a lot of counters, registers, data buses, and the video circuit has the same. It also has counters, it has control, it has memory, and it sounded very redundant to us. So what we decided to do is we wanted to have another design where basically these two circuits were one circuit. So either you can see it as a video circuit that can also execute instructions, or you can see it as a CPU that can also synthesize video signals along the way. And that can be done timing-wise. That's not too much of an issue. If you remember the Quark 85 demo, the video signal, it's a continuous signal, but most of the time is dead time, where the signal does not change. Only at 31 kilohertz you have to synthesize a synchronization pulse, and then there is a lot of dead time where you are supposed to send black data, and then there is only 480 out of the 525 actually lines that contain visible data and where your circuit has to be active. But in all those dead time, and you can increase the amount of dead time if you insert nice retro scan lines, you can run programs. So that was the idea. We make a CPU that switches very quickly between applications and video and sound, actually. And the first thing that meant that the reference design, the SAP1 design, was not going to work because it was based on a single bus, and every instruction had to move, all the data movements were going over this central bus, and every instruction took multiple cycles because of that, and you could never make a fast enough pixel burst with that. So we made a different design where the data basically always goes in one direction, and I'm not going through this whole diagram, but the whole idea is that it is more like a RISC system, and the data goes in a pipe in one direction, and that allows it to do one instruction every cycle. And there is no data bus that is used two times in the same instruction. That is the basis. So when we had the data path more or less figured out, we knew nothing about the instruction set, only the data path for video and doing calculations. We started to build it in Ben Eater style. You figure out how many breadboards you are going to need for your 40 chips. Well, I decided eight should be enough. There is still some bus in the middle for usefulness. There are two ROMs, one for the instructions, one for the data. Here is my program counter, four chips together, 16-bit program counter. Here's my instruction register, the data register. I knew I needed a RAM. I knew I needed some way to create addresses for the RAM. I knew I needed an X register and a Y register. And the rest, I basically didn't know. This all changed later, but the idea was here to put the ALU, the calculation unit, and this was all the space I had for control unit for decoding the instructions. In April 2017, we had the ALU working. We used a design that is basically a mix with adder chips and multiplexers, which I won't go into here. It's a very nice design, which we didn't make. Actually, we took these designs from somewhere and we simplified it. And then in the end, when we were starting to build the instruction set, we figured out how many, what would be a useful instruction set to control this computer. And basically, we found out that we could have 8 or 16 instructions, depending on how you count them, based on a very orthogonal division of the instruction register. So the instruction register has 8 bits, and 3 of those bits, they designate what the ALU is going to do. So if it's going to do an AND or an OR or an XOR or a load, just a load from the bus or add. And 2 of the unused instructions are used for a store instruction or a jump instruction. 3 of the bits are used to select what kind of address is given to the RAM and which of the user registers receives the output of the ALU. And then 2 of the other bits are used to give access to the bus, to one of the 4 sources of data. The sources of data are either the operand of the instruction, or it is the input port, or it is the accumulator, or it is the memory. Those 4 are allowed to write on the bus, and 2 of the bits in the instruction set arrange for that. The addressing modes are the same for all the instructions, except for the jump instruction. Then the same signals are used to decode the condition of the jump. And the condition of the jump is based on the value of the accumulator. We don't have a status register because that's too much hardware, so we only look at the accumulator. We take a look and compare it to 0, basically. And you can jump if it is positive, negative, equal to 0, different from 0, equal, greater or equal to 0. All those combinations are possible. You can make an unconditional jump. All those jumps are in the same 256-byte memory segment. And to escape from a memory segment, we have a var jump instruction that takes the low byte from the bus and the high byte from the Y register, and then you can jump anywhere in memory. It's very basic. There is no hardware stack. There are no interrupts. Almost nothing is there, but you can do decent programming with this, as it turns out. And this is a design we could implement it with 6 TTL chips and 30 diodes and 2 resistors, or one resistor. And in May, basically 1 month later after we started building, we had a computer. It's not fully built yet, this area is not completed, but it could read, calculate the Fibonacci series. It didn't have output, so I had to verify the correctness on an oscilloscope. So my binary skills improved there. But it did it in a loop, and I could I simplified it a bit. I put it on 1 megahertz, and I could measure that the loop was exactly as long as it should be on paper and to do the whole series. And I could verify that the highest number was indeed what it should be, was 144 or something like that. I forgot. But that's Fibonacci. Yeah, oh, nice. And this is the code. I'm not going through the code, but it's a very basic, simple program. You see all these knob instructions everywhere. They're actually not knob instructions, because there's no knob instruction. It is an instruction that loads the accumulator with itself. And the reason that they are there is that it's a pipeline system. When the computer is executing the instruction, the next instruction is already fetched from the EEPROM. Because the EEPROM is very slow, you do that in parallel, so you have a RISC machine. But it also means that if you do a branch, you still get 1 free instruction from your original execution stream. And if you put a knob there, then you don't suffer from that. My modern programs abuse this branch delay slot in all kinds of spectacular ways. And now the system could not ever work even if we removed that branch delay slot, make it a single non-RISC machine, a lot of Cipher software will not even work because we do tricks with two branches in a row, that kind of things that are can do nice tricks with that. At the end of that month, we had pixel out and we had moving video because it's nice if you have basically what you're seeing here is the contents of an uninitialized static RAM. Apparently, the low bytes in a page have a different bias to one than the other half of the RAM. Here you see a line in the memory that is something that the program put in there, so I can see that it is outputting the correct rows. And here you see this band that was in the video, you can see it is scrolling like a scroll text, but it is a random noise that's in there. So that was basically working after 6 weeks that we had started with the bad board and not a full design. So the low-level instruction set was working. And then at some point, we put a real picture in the RAM. Well, why not put a picture of itself and have a little scroll text on the top? And we put a blinking LED on the highest address line that we were not using. And we simulated the blinking of the LED here in the picture. So that was the self-aware breadboard. But it is a computer and a video card at the same time, and there is almost nothing in there. There's no standard instruction set because of minimization. There are no standard adapter chips. There's no, the address space is two-dimensional because you need more chips to make it linear. There is actually no relative addressing because you need an adder for that, and why not also have two parts? There's no flags register. There's not even a register file. There's only one accumulator that you that's really usable. There are no timer chips, there's no sound chip, no video chip, no interrupts. But our thinking is there's not even a reset button. Our thinking is if it can be done in software, you don't need the hardware for it. And we take that to the extreme. A few weeks later, we had this little program. It is basically still the video loop that is drawing these blocks. But in a little bit of extra time, it moves this little ball around and it looks at the input so you can move this pedal around. And every time the ball hits a non-black pixel, it blacks out that area. And actually, it blacks out that area every frame of the video. And every time it hits, it just changes the pointer where it starts blacking out, drawing black boxes. So everything is basically static code with no conditionals. The application logic is mixed with the video generation logic, and as VGA signals are have to be extremely precise, every 31 microseconds you must generate your horizontal pulse and it must come from software. And if you delay it by just a fraction of a microsecond, most of the modern monitors will stop displaying your video. So everything you write must be cycle exact. And in application code, that becomes extremely tedious. So we went one step further. Our application that was running, we changed that into an interpreter. And the interpreter is inspired by Suite 16, which was an interpreter that was running in the Apple II ROM. It allowed Apple to do 16-bit applications in small code space. And in our case, it allows us to have the instructions time themselves. And they know, are aware of how much time they are taking, and they can give back control to the video code just before they run out of their time slice. And we made them 16 bits because for most applications, 8 bits is really not enough. And we squeezed in one memory page, we squeezed 32 instructions. Actually, the opcodes for those instructions are the offsets into that code page. And there are different kinds of add and branch and conditional branch instructions on 16 bits. And that is where we program our applications in. And the low-level code, which is in the ROM, does the video signals, the sound, we added sound. It can access the ROM as a big ROM disk for applications that must be loaded into RAM first. And the interpreter runs in there. And we can talk to the outside world through the input controller and a little Arduino. We can send programs into the memory, into the RAM, and then execute it. And that's how I normally do the development. And every time when I run out of steam with my high-level instruction set, I can still write an extension in 8-bit native code, but it has to be timing aware, and but you can make nice accelerations out of that. So the first programs we wrote with that higher-level system is a little scroller text demo, the snake game that is still in the ROM, the racer game that is still in the ROM, and those games can be controlled by a little game controller. So that was actually Snake was running. We were really, really happy. And why do people stop at that moment? Okay, that has a nice project. Please stop there. But then I met Oscar Vermeulen, who is also here. Maybe he's here in the room, I don't know. He's sitting next to me. He's doing the little PyDP 8 and PyDP 11 kits. And he mentioned that, yeah, there is no product obscure enough that people are not interested in. And actually, a lot of our friends, they wanted to have this. And I said, yeah. So we talked, actually, Walter had already joined at the time. So, okay, let's make it a kit. It's fun to make a kit. You should have done that at least once in your life. Just like you should have made your own CPU, you should have made your kit once in your life. So 10 weeks later, we had a PCB. I never designed a PCB before. And I can assure you, you should not start with something big as this. You should start with something small. but it was 10 weeks of work. And here you can see the whole structure of the computer again. You see the input register, you see the program counter, so it's four-bit counters. You have the EEPROM, you have the decoding, the RAM, the address unit, and the ALU. And then the analog output for sound and for output. And that's all there is to it. Actually, we did the gate count with compare it to a real MOS 6502, and we found that our CPU part has half the gates of the 6502 processor from the day. But because it's TTL, it's much faster. Those are faster transistors than were possible in the NMOS processes for the microprocessors. Because of microprocessors, they were really not designed for computers. They were designed for calculators and for terminals. I'm going to skip this one. If you make a kit, you need a nice enclosure. So we found a factory that could make them in low volume for us and put all the holes and have a nice display view wing, because this is a thing you want to look at, not hide in a box. If you need a kit, a lot of people are maybe a little bit rusty in their soldering or have never soldered before. Well, I don't recommend that you use this as your first soldering project. But we know that people have, and they have made it work at the first go. And that is mostly thanks to the manual that Walter wrote. It's extremely detailed with good color photos. And then comes the real work, because you have to put all the components, and we have more than 50 different component types in there, and ship them, and people start ordering them. And we found out it's more than 1 hour of work altogether. To run a kit business, so don't know how long we are going to keep doing that. Because suddenly, instead of 400 chips, you're buying 10,000 of chips and hundreds of boxes. And instead, I was used to buying resistors, and you get 10 on a little thing. But now you get resistors on these rolls that they put in pick-and-place machines. And but it is there. It is now a thing you can buy as a soldering kit, and. We're extremely proud that people from all over the world, we have shipped them now to 45 countries. And it's especially fun if you have to write people's work address on it, because some people order it from work. So we have shipped them to the headquarters of Microsoft, to the headquarters of Facebook, to the headquarters of Apple, the headquarters of ARM, of all. All of them have ordered. And the Living Computers Museum in Seattle is also one of our customers. So a new one is built every day. That's my estimate. And people start, even it's not easy to write programs for it, people are doing that. In the first months, we had line drawing programs. We had sprites, people, Game of Life. We had two Tetris games. We sent one to the 8-bit guy. I don't know if you know him, it's a famous YouTube channel, and EEV block. has reviewed it. But in reality, it was a little bit of a shitty computer because there was no keyboard hookup and there was not even a BASIC built in. So you could only use the applications that were in there. And still, people were buying it, but they said, ah, it's a little bit of a gadget. So 2 months after launching, we developed a little adapter for PS2 keyboards because the Arduino code had libraries for that. And we add a little keyboard adapter to the kit, so you can hook up a keyboard. That took away one concern. And then somebody pointed us that in the first issue of Dr. Dobbs ever, there was the source code for what was called Tiny Basic, which is a 2 kilobyte basic that was very stripped down, but it was only 2 kilobytes. And we ported that to our virtual CPU. And we added 4 statements, and we added actually line drawing statements. But then we could write little basic programs in it, and then it becomes more or less a nice, cute little computer system that you can toy with. And actually, I had to do Fibonacci again. But now I have BASIC and I have arrays, so you can do Fibonacci in big numbers, arbitrary large numbers, no problem. And the games that people have written, there's a nice Tetris, it's now in the standard ROM, and there is a really nice clone of the Breakout game that Steve Wozniak once designed for Atari. And this lookalike is in there. So it becomes a little bit complete. You still have to program it over an Arduino, which I think is annoying, if that is still necessary. So the last year we have worked on a little expander board. This is 4 extra TTL chips around the old RAM chip. And with a previously illegal opcode, it can control a register, and that register is now configured that it creates 4 SPI ports. So those are high-speed serial ports. But it's only the register, so if you want to use it, you still have to toggle the bits manually from your software. We have support routines for that. And currently I'm working, here you see a breakout board for an SD card. And at this moment, I got it as far that I can read the root directory of that. This is actually our Git repro clone. read it, and actually we can load a file from it and boot it. That's just how far we are. We don't have write access. Here you see the date, 2019, September 11. It's not year 2001 or 2100 compliant, but that starts to work. And in May, I suddenly had a lot of time, and I was a little bit bored, and I said, well, we have this virtual CPU that can run 16-bit code. Can we not make our processor, our non-CPU or non-microprocessor dual core? So we added a second virtual CPU. And that one is actually executing 6502 code, 8-bit code. It's very slowly because it's still compatible with all the video signals, and they're also compatible with the old vCPU, so you can basically in one instruction switch between the 2 instruction sets. So the expected speed, the whole machine runs at 6 megahertz, but the effective 6502 speed is a quarter or an eighth of an original 6502 CPU. But with that, we could run WASMON, original WASMON. Actually, that was all the Apple software, all the software that the Apple One shipped with. We have it now hidden as an Easter egg in our ROM. We have the disassembler that Wozniak once wrote in there. It disassembles nice 6502 code. And that was an easy program because it fits in one page. And this week I wanted to do a real test of our 6502 code, so I took Mikhail Stiles source codes for the Commodore BASICs, or the Microsoft BASICs actually. And I relocated it such that it fits in the memory map of the Gigatron. I had to cheat a little bit because it's 8 kilobytes big and I only have 2 kilobytes available. So I stole a lot of black space or unused space from the video screen, which you don't see here, but it has only 11 rows of text instead of 15 rows of text, and that gives me just enough to fit in Microsoft Basic, reorganize it. It's really cramped because if you're familiar with the 6502, it has the stack in page 1, but the Gigatron is already using that, so I put the stack in page 0, which is for Microsoft is already very full. But this Friday, it was for the first time counting correctly the amount of free memory. This is the same amount of free memory as the VIC-20, and it's a complete coincidence. And this morning it was for the first time doing 9-digit floating point on a computer without a microprocessor. And it really worked. All the bugs, I think, are now fixed, so we can write proper applications with this. Well, remember our original goal to make a small circuit that can play tic-tac-toe on the LED matrix. It turns out that somewhere in 1974 or 75, a guy wrote a tic-tac-toe version in BASIC. Tom Pittman did that. Was for Tiny BASIC, and that is now also included in the Gigatron as a BASIC application. So finally, we have our computer that can play tic-tac-toe, but this is not on an LED matrix. We're done with the with the project. And we have a little bit of time for questions, I think. Actually, I can show it. Let's not forget that, because we have one running here. Let's switch it on. Is it? There we are. So this is the signal is generated from this computer here. Do we have the sound switched on? Can we have the sound from the system as well? Tube. There we go. Yeah. So this is Tetris. It's actually quite addictive game. Well, we don't have a reset button on the board, but we have a reset on the game controller, so there's all software. So you can always go back. This is the other one of the nicer, visually nicer games. It reminds me a little bit of the VIC-20 games. It's not quite C64 stuff, but it's definitely better than the ZX Spectrum and VIC-20 and the Atari 2600, which are all much older technology that's running there. And well, it can, of course, it can draw Mandelbrot fractals. And what you can see here also is that you see this little black scan lines, which is used for the application. We can change the video mode by pressing the select button, and you see it slow down, because then there's almost no time in the video signal available for calculations, and then you can speed it up by just showing fewer pixels, and if you make it very bright, it runs around the screen really fast. So it's, the user can decide how he wants to experience the system. Thank you. We're well in time, that's great. Yeah, in the back.
Thank you for the keynote, it was great. Just a question regarding the SD card and the file system. I saw a FAT implementation, I think.
Yes.
So where you got it from?
Unfortunately, I wrote it all myself, and it's not finished. It can read a little bit of FAT, and as long as the file stays within one FAT sector, it can read it, and the linking from the FAT table is not really working yet. And I don't know how to continue, because if I support writing, it's a thing, and I don't want to do all the work for writing and all the different file system variations.
Yes.
So I should look around for a good code base that I can steal or borrow.
Yes, so I can give you a hint, because I'm one of the stack swine guys, and we have a FAT 32 implementation. Maybe it's...
I'm going to talk with you. Yeah, somebody already noted me.
thank you.
And they already encouraged me to implement a 6.5C02, because then you can access more code. The 65CO2 is the CMOS version of the 6502, but it has all, it's a lot more useful instructions added to it. But thank you. Okay, little break and some water.
All right, thanks very much.